Reply hazy, try again. I never find anything at the flea. I complained to Maggie as we circumnavigated a couple attempting to get that perfect Instagram shot with the Manhattan Bridge in the background. A crowd had formed on the street, young and trendy, some holding accessories like flowers or balloons, some in fashionable hats. I wondered if they were all waiting their turn for that aspirational snap. I hoped not. You really have to dig, Maggie said. And you have to go regularly. It's like prospecting. Okay, Yosemite Sam, I laughed. Prospecting? Done a lot of prospecting? Yes, can't you tell? I'm pure gold, baby, she said, spinning around and lowering her oversized sunglasses to give me a wink. Maggie was very glamorous. She had impeccable style. Her closet was full of vintage finds. It helped that everything looked good on her. Some people are lucky like that. Not me. We got to where the vendors were set up under the bridge and started browsing. Maggie was an intense browser. She liked to stop and examine everything. She was easily compelled. I once made the mistake of going to MoMA with her, and we were there for 7 hours. I wasn't a lingerer. It took a lot to catch my interest and a hell of a lot to keep it. We spent a while thumbing through time-worn postcards and subway maps, observing antique furniture. Then we wandered toward the bins of old action figures and plastic soldiers and displaced Happy Meal toys and limbless baby dolls, all interspersed with matchbooks and baseball cards and buttons and marbles. It was crap, basically. Just a bunch of crap being sold at a Brooklyn premium. Who buys this stuff? I whispered to Maggie, who was admiring a mustached McNugget in a cowboy hat. There's a nostalgia factor, she said. An indirect answer. I sighed. It's good to have things around that bring you joy, she said. And it was as she said this that I spotted the magic eight ball tucked away in a random bin, wedged between a Viewmaster and a filthy Cabbage Patch Kid. I reached for it before I understood what I was doing, before I could question what kind of germs occupied its surface. I held it in my hands, turned it around. I couldn't tell how old it was. If it had been swiped from a Target discount shelf last month, or discovered in some grandfather's basement, a precious relic from a childhood long ago. I gave it a good shake, then read what it had to say. Its first words to me. Without a doubt. Oh, cool, Maggie said. I always wanted one of those. You should get it. I wasn't a frivolous spender, but for some reason the eight ball seemed like a necessity. Yeah, I said. I should. When I brought it to the vendor, a man in a backward cap and oversized flannel, he furrowed his brow.
Where'd you find that?
That bin over there, I said, pointing. He shrugged, then looked me up and down and said,
$20.
It seemed steep, and I almost put it back, but there was something about the weight of it in my hand, how it fit so perfectly in my palm, the way my fingers curled around it, an easy grip. I wanted it. And right as I had this thought, right as the want took root, I looked down at the eight ball, and now it said, yes, definitely. I thought it a funny coincidence. 15, I told the vendor.
Okay,
he said, nodding. I'd never haggled before. It was exhilarating. Look at you, Maggie said. Miss, I never find anything at the flea. I cradled the eight ball in my hands. I knew it was illogical to have spent $15 on something I could have gotten for half that from Amazon, and I, typically, felt immediate guilt after any impulse purchase, even something as small as gum at the register. I waited for the buyer's remorse to set in, surprised it hadn't already. Well, I guess this is the exception. See, Jordy? When you loosen up and are open to things, you find them, and they find you. I laughed, charmed by Maggie's faith. Sure, if you say so. And you know, you're the only one who can get away with calling me that. Come on, Jordan. Let's keep looking. See what treasure awaits. As we walked, I glanced down at the eight ball. Outlook good, it said. Later, Maggie and I sat in Brooklyn Bridge Park eating sesame bagels with too much cream cheese and drinking iced coffee, savoring our patch of grass and the view of downtown Manhattan. Maggie admired the cameo brooch she had bought at the flea. I took the 8-ball out of my bag. Yes, it said. That will be useful, Maggie said. You tend to be indecisive.
Me? No, never, I said.
I shook the 8-ball, which now read, as I see it, yes. I put it back in my bag. You should ask it if Kenny is going to propose. I said, suddenly queasy. Apologies, Maggie said, pulling at her collar. I was just thinking of silly sleepover questions. Does he like me? Is he going to ask me out? Considering you're already past that, well... I shoved some bagel in my mouth as an excuse not to respond. Let's ask it something better, Maggie said, sitting up on her knees. Why don't we ask it if we'll be friends forever? Really? I asked. Really? She said. Please, let's have a little fun. All right. I fished out the 8-ball and asked, will Maggie and I be friends forever? I closed my eyes and shook. I opened my eyes. When I saw what it said, I gasped. What? Maggie leaned over to see. She read it out loud. Better not tell you now. Huh, how mysterious. It's a toy, I said, slipping it into my bag and then zipping the bag shut. Yes, Maggie said. Still. Still what? She shook her head and then tilted her gaze up toward the high noon sun. She was like a sunflower, always seeking the light. She had her summer freckles, abundant across her nose and the tops of her shoulders. It's such a beautiful day, she said. Yeah, I said. Beautiful. Kenny was in the kitchen making gnocchi, making a mess.
Hey, he said, how was the flea?
You know, the flea, I said, searching the fridge for a seltzer.
Get anything?
No. The lie made a hasty escape. It caught me off guard.
Oh, well, he said. Did Maggie?
Yeah, she always does. She got a brooch. He raised an eyebrow.
What's that?
A decorative pin, I said. It was what my mother would have called a comma dumbass sentence. When I was a teenager, I developed a problem with my delivery, my tone. My condescension was out of control. My mother would say, if it sounds like there's an implied comma dumbass at the end of the sentence, try again. I opened my mouth ready to apologize to Kenny for how I'd spoken to him, but part of me resented having to take responsibility for his obliviousness. I changed my mind.
Ah, he said, unaffected. Like grandma's wear.
Exactly.
Cool, he said. Dinner will probably be around 7.
All right, I'm going to go for a run. He gave a murmur of acknowledgement and returned his concentration to the gnocchi slash mess. I went into the bedroom and changed out of my sundress and into my running gear. I pulled my hair back. I stretched. I thought about the 8-ball, where I could put it that Kenny wouldn't find it. I didn't understand why I was so averse to him discovering it, to him touching it, but the idea made me itchy. I thought he might disturb its energy, which I knew was ridiculous. It was unlike me to indulge in such ridiculousness. Still, I took out the 8-ball and asked it, am I being an idiot? Concentrate and ask again, it said. I huffed. I closed my eyes and gave it some thought. Is it silly that I don't want Kenny to know about you? That I don't want him to touch you with his gnocchi fingers? My reply is no, it said. Is that more about me or more about Kenny? As soon as I asked, I knew it was too complex a question for an 8-ball. I whispered, is it him? Ask again later. Is it me? Concentrate and ask again. All right, I said. I opened the drawer of my nightstand, moving aside glasses cases and assorted tubes of hand lotion to make space for it. I was closing the drawer when I saw the 8-ball now said, bye. I didn't know that was one of the responses. Bye, I said. And then I went for my run. Maggie came by my desk the next morning for our usual 9 o'clock coffee run. She was wearing a plaid blazer with the brooch on her lapel. Her hair was in a French braid.
She wore lipstick, and I noticed because she didn't usually. It was a divine shade of lavender. "Should we go get Chrissy?" I asked on the way to the elevators. Occasionally, Chrissy, the administrative assistant on Maggie's team, would join us. I liked her. She was fresh out of college and brimming with nervous energy. She always had a story about a hot hookup, about a wild night out, about someone she liked who didn't like her back, about the perils of app dating. She complained about her roommates, about the intricate dramas of unwashed dishes and who paid for toilet paper. She made me feel grateful for my age, for the fact those chaos years were behind me. There are too many hard lessons to be learned in your early 20s. Too much crying outside of H&R Block, in bars, on the subway, in some random hookup's dingy bathroom. Too much crying. Now that I was 30, I barely cried. I was delightfully numb, and I could afford things like venti Starbucks beverages every morning, an Uber during a downpour, after-work cocktails, meditation apps, small luxuries that made the days easier. "She's out today," Maggie said. "Sick day." "Poor baby." "Please," Maggie said. "She's probably hungover." I laughed. "Poor baby." Maggie shook her head and pressed the elevator button. When the doors closed, she did a funny dance. She liked to dance when we were alone in the elevator. I liked to watch. "What if there are cameras?" I asked her once. "Free show," she said, spinning around. "You're welcome." We got off on the 10th floor and headed to our little corporate cafeteria Starbucks. "So, what will it be today?" Maggie asked me. "Back on the chai train, a flat white, a red eye, maybe a matcha?" She was mocking me because I changed my order every day, constantly waffling about what I wanted while waiting in line. I could never settle on a signature drink. "Not sure," I said, thinking. "This is why you need the 8-ball," she said. "The 8-ball isn't going to advise me on if I want a hot hazelnut latte or a caramelized coffee." "It might," she said, "and it might tell you to just send that email without reading it 4,000 times. "I'm a lawyer," I said. "I'm meticulous." "Sure," she said, grinning. "So, what'd you do last night?" I shrugged. "Went for a run. Kenny made gnocchi." "Did he? Impressive." I waited for her to tell me that I was lucky. That's what everyone said. I was so lucky to have Kenny. I knew they meant well. Still, I thought it was mildly insulting at best, dangerous at worst, to say this to someone. Relationships are complicated, and no one could ever really know what goes on from the outside looking in. Why reinforce a reliance, a codependence? Why create this completely unnecessary sense of desperate gratitude? Kenny was great. He was affable and creative and generous, but he was also terribly irresponsible with money and a certified slob. To tell me that I was lucky to be with him dismissed his flaws and my contributions. I did his taxes. I set up his IRA. So lucky. I wasn't certain about much, but I was certain that when it came to relationships, luck was never in play. At least, fairly certain. "Make your decision, miss," Maggie said. "You're up." "You go first." "Nope," she said. Her flat palm moved up my back and landed between my shoulder blades. She gave me a gentle nudge forward. My body prickled in the wake of her touch. I stammered at the counter. I'm sorry. Hazelnut, no, sorry. Caramelized coffee, please. Venti light ice. Thank you." I heard Maggie giggling behind me. I gave her a look and she put her hands up in surrender. We waited for our drinks and then said our goodbyes at the elevator, going to our separate sides of the floor. I'd been at the company only a few months. Before I started, I worried about the rigid corporate environment, but I ran into Maggie in the bathroom my first week and she invited me to coffee. We became fast friends, a rare fluency between us I'd never quite experienced before. I was excited about her. I told Kenny, all my friends, I'd find any excuse to talk about her. "Maggie has perfect skin, and she swears by Cetaphil. Maggie gave me the recipe for this bomb salad dressing. Maggie also loves," insert movie, TV show, musical artist, food, writer, podcast, etc. As a kid, Maggie almost drowned in Lake Champlain, and she swears Champy saved her. "I'm glad you made a friend at work," Kenny would say. "We should have her over." And when he said it, I felt the same way as I did about him with the eight ball when I brought it home. I didn't want to let him anywhere near her. The following weekend, Kenny and I went to Coney Island with his best friend slash former college roommate, Sam, and Sam's new girlfriend, Alexa, who'd never been. "It's not how I pictured it would be," she said, her disappointment tangible, contagious. I felt myself catch it, the threatening tickle of it in the back of my throat. It proliferated swiftly, suffusing me with negativity, cynicism. When Kenny and I had first started dating, we were constantly taking trips to Coney Island to ride the Cyclone and eat Nathan's and walk up and down the boardwalk playing new relationship trivia, where the answer to every question is always prize-worthy. And the prize is you. Did you ever get injured in gym class growing up? Yes, that is very endearing. You move on to the next round. A few years in, we already knew pretty much everything there was to know about each other. There was no trivia left. The prize already won. I knew that in third grade, Kenny had bruised his coccyx in an unfortunate scooter board derby accident. The injury forced him to sleep on his stomach, something he still did to this day. I knew what he was allergic to, shellfish, penicillin. I knew everything he loved, thunderstorms, Dave Grohl, the Yankees, Italian subs, Prospect Park Frisbee, me. I knew his social security number. We were together. Game over. It wasn't that I found him uninteresting. He was well-read and curious. He consumed new information daily and would share it with me over dinner or over text as we attempted to fall asleep. "Did you know that aluminum is infinitely recyclable?" he'd said to me the night before as I popped in my retainers. "No," I responded. "I didn't." "That's interesting." I meant it, but for some reason it came out with a hint of sarcasm. That was when I realized if someone you're bored with tells you something compelling, it really doesn't matter what it is. He could have told me that NASA had video footage of little green aliens doing the Macarena on Mars, and I would have yawned. "Skee-ball?" Kenny asked me, dragging me out of my head and back to Luna Park. "Jordan is the skee-ball queen." "It's true," I said, and then proceeded to dominate. I missed the paper tickets, plastic tokens. It was all digital now, your points downloaded onto a card. I felt sorry for younger generations. When I expressed this to the group, Sam shrugged and said, "It's easier this way." I looked to Kenny, who nodded in agreement, then to Alexa, who wasn't paying attention. I turned back to Kenny. He smiled at me. I felt very alone. That's when I realized if you're looking at someone that you're supposed to love and you feel alone, you have a big problem. I had a big problem. "I'll be right back." I handed my arcade card to Kenny and said, "Go crazy." "Oh, baby, you treat me so nice," he replied in a funny voice. I didn't laugh. I found the nearest bathroom and locked myself in a stall. It smelled terrible, and there was damp toilet paper on the floor, but I found it preferable to the arcade. "I'm sorry," I whispered to the eight ball as I removed it from my bag. "I apologize for taking you out in these less than ideal surroundings, but I need to ask." I held the eight ball in both hands and closed my eyes. "Am I losing my mind?" "Very doubtful," it said. "Do I love him anymore?" Outlook, not so good. It was a strange sensation to simultaneously experience the relief of validation and the stark cruelty of the truth. "Why?" I asked. "Why?" Reply hazy. "Try again." I slipped the eight ball back into my bag, wrapping it in a scarf. When I emerged from the bathroom, the stink of it lingered on me. I walked away from the arcade and toward the ocean. I stepped onto the sand, my feet sinking with every step. I watched the waves simmering in the sun. I witnessed the relentless push and pull of the tide. I liked how small and fragile it made me feel. How powerless. "You can't do anything about anything," the ocean seemed to say. "So why bother?" I wanted to walk into the water. I wanted to march straight into the ocean's mouth and have it swallow me up. I thought about Maggie almost drowning in Lake Champlain. I thought about Champy, the American Loch Ness monster. I thought about how sweet it was, her faith in folklore. The first time we had gone for drinks after work, she told me she wanted to take a weekend trip to the Pine Barrens to search for the Jersey Devil. Why? I asked her. She smiled against the rim of her coupe, a gin gimlet swirling below, anxious to meet her lips. Because, she said, because I like to meet other strange creatures. Good to know I'm not alone. On the train back from Coney Island, Kenny held my hand. It wasn't typical behavior, but Sam had his arm around Alexa, so perhaps he felt obligated. The four of us went to dinner at a restaurant near Sam's apartment in Ditmas Park, and afterward we walked around admiring the neighborhood houses. We should live here, Kenny said to me. Get one of these, chill on the porch. Sure, I said. Definitely. I like this area, he said. I wondered if he was serious, if he actually thought we could afford one of the massive Victorians. I wondered what it was like to be such an idealist. I wanted a cigarette. Is it too far to walk? He asked me. To walk home? No, I said. Probably about 45 minutes. Cool. Down to walk? Yep. I reached into my bag and felt for the 8-ball. I wondered what it said now, if anything. My phone vibrated against the back of my hand. I took it out. I had a text from Maggie. Brunch tomorrow? Yes, please, I thought. I need to tell you about Coney Island. I need to ask if you miss the paper arcade tickets like I do. If you too appreciated the tangible victory. If you're also sad about the digitization of the world. I need to know if you understand, because I really think you will. But I didn't say any of that. I didn't respond at all. I need. I clutched the 8-ball. I faked sick on Monday. I lied to Kenny, to my manager. Migraine, I told them. To Maggie, I said nothing. I sat alone in my apartment, curtains drawn, chewing on my nails and hovering over the 8-ball. Should I break up with Kenny? Yes. Fuck, I said. When? Don't count on it. What does that mean? Jordan. I blinked. I shook it again. Jordan. My mouth went dry. My eyes, then my body floated away. It was my name, in a neat white font, on the blue triangle in the round window. My name. And then, the triangle began to move, all on its own. It rolled backward to reveal a new message. Come on. And again. You know. Again, you already know. All this, you've known for a while. The ball slid from my sweat-slick hands down to the floor with a thunk. At first, I was too terrified to lean over to pick it up. But after a few minutes passed, I was too scared not to. I didn't want to upset it. I reached with trembling fingers. Ow, it said. Ow. Are you feeling better? Kenny asked me when he got home from work. No, I said, which was technically true. Oh, he said, haunting the doorway. Do you need anything? Don't think so, I said, collapsing back onto my pillow. Trying to sleep it off. Okay, well, if you need anything, just holler. Yep. When I heard the door latch, I returned to what I was doing, using my phone as a flashlight inside my fortress of sheets, interrogating the 8-ball. Will I be any happier if I leave him? I asked for the 10th time. Cannot predict now, it answered for the 10th time. Really? I asked it. Or do you just not want to tell me? Enough already, it replied. I sighed. What good are you if you can't give me specific instructions or guarantee my eternal happiness? Hey now, it said. I was kidding. Even so. I didn't have to shake it anymore. It responded all on its own, the triangle shifting inside the mysterious blue liquid. "I'm sorry," I mumbled, putting it back in my nightstand drawer. I turned over and swaddled myself in the sheets. I tried to recall when exactly I'd started being unhappy, when I'd fallen out of love with Kenny. I couldn't pinpoint a moment. I tried to remember when I first knew that I loved Kenny and why, but I couldn't identify that either. I began to question whether I had ever loved him, or if I was just doing what I thought I was supposed to be doing. At 26, meet someone at the birthday party of a mutual friend, flirt over a pitcher of cheap beer, exchange numbers, talk for a week over text, then go out to dinner, get along, have decent sex, continue hanging out, decide to move in together. The city is so expensive. Why not? We're old enough. Why not? Isn't it so great to find someone to be with, to share a life with? My old boss asked me when I took the day off to move. When I came back to the office the following Monday, I found a card on my desk signed by all my coworkers congratulating me on my new place. They collectively bought me a housewarming gift, a small ficus. It was a sweet gesture, I guess, but a real pain to transport on the train. It was as I presented this ficus to Kenny that I decided I wanted a new job, that I didn't want to go back to that office. I was embarrassed. I didn't quite know why. It took me a while to find a new position, and by then I'd sort of forgotten about the ficus. It had died. I retrieved the eight ball from my drawer. I felt untethered, uncertain that I'd ever decided anything for myself. I was infamously meticulous, agonizing endlessly over logistics. It was always about what made sense, about meeting expectations, perceived success, never about what would make me happy, what I desired. Want was a non-factor. Kenny and I had been together for 4 years, so it wasn't uncommon for us to get asked when we planned on getting married. My reaction was instant nausea, but also, I would think, probably next fall. Why had I always been so content to ignore my own discontentment? Why now this crisis of faith? "Is it you?" I asked the eight ball. "My reply is no." "Is it me?" "Very doubtful." I took a breath. Why now this want? "Is it her?" I didn't need to look to know the answer. In an act of true cowardice, I arranged to work from home for the rest of the week, citing cluster headaches. "Are you all right? Miss you at the office," Maggie texted me. "Headaches," I replied, a heat rising in my cheeks. "Get them this time of year, usually last a few days." "A few days?" she said. "How can I survive here without you?" I fumbled for the eight ball. "Is Maggie into me?" I asked. "Nice try." In the hot haze of frustration, I spat, "You're fucking useless," and shoved it away. I watched in horror as it slowly rolled itself back toward me. It stopped just shy of my fingertips, its murky eye face up, glaring at me. The blue triangle floated into view, the lettering on it now red instead of white. "Be careful," it said. I reached for it, ready to shut it in my drawer and pretend it didn't exist, but then I saw it said, "Don't you dare." I pulled my hand away and my knees to my chest, rocking back and forth, staring at it. "Apologize and ask again."
I'm sorry, I said, a pathetic quaver warping my voice. Is Maggie into me?"
"Cannot predict now." The letters were white again.
"Okay," I squeaked. "Thank you."
"Ask again later." I didn't want to, but I knew I would.
Kenny went out to dinner with his coworkers that Thursday, so I took a walk to pick up some pho for myself, forcing myself out of the apartment and away from the eight ball, which I'd been obsessively checking for 48 hours straight. Sneaking it into the bathroom in the middle of the night while Kenny was asleep, kneeling on the wet floor and just holding it, waiting for it to tell me something, anything. It wasn't good. It wasn't healthy. I was scaring myself. I felt out of control.
I left early and wandered a bit. I studied everyone I passed. A mother in a business casual wrap dress and loafers, scrolling on her phone as her son scootered beside her, his helmet comically large. A student with a hot pink backpack slung over her shoulder, drinking a grande frappuccino with whip, the Bose noise-canceling headphones that I deemed too expensive hanging around her neck like jewelry. A man in unironic corduroy overalls smoking a cigarette and staring right at me. Two women, their arms around each other. One in a satin jumpsuit that looked like chic pajamas, the other in high-waisted jeans and a white-ribbed tank. One wearing makeup, the other none. One with a septum piercing and a tattoo sleeve. The other might have had piercings and tattoos, but they were secrets. They were obviously together. They moved in sync, as if they were a single entity with four legs. They laughed, and I clung to the rhythm of their laughter, wanting to commit it to memory so I could access it again, fearing I might never experience it for myself. I picked up my soup and brought it home. I ate it on the living room floor, resisting the temptation of the eight ball in the other room. I could hear it rolling itself around in my drawer, knocking against the wood, rattling my things. I watched a documentary about an infamous art heist to distract myself, volume up high. I thought it was a shame that the paintings had never been found, but admired the audacity of the thieves. I pictured a Rembrandt collecting dust in someone's basement. I pictured my own heart. I relented. When? I asked the eight ball as I sat on the bathroom floor underneath the towel rack, my forehead against the wall, a used towel draped over me like a damp veil. It was 4 o'clock in the morning. Tonight, it said.
Really? Tonight?
Yes. So, after Kenny left for work, I packed a suitcase and booked a hotel. The room was expensive, but I figured I would want to be alone after I did it, if I did it. I could recognize Kenny's footsteps coming down the hall, his particular cadence. I felt a leap of regret, but my suitcase was already packed, and I had no backup excuse, no way of explaining it away. I realized I should have just left. I shouldn't have waited for him to come home. Was it really noble to do it in person? Was there anything noble about what was about to go down? He opened the door. "Hey," he said, "you're up. Are you feeling better?" Was the decision rash? Was I being too impulsive? Was it the influence of the eight ball?
"Not really," I said. "I have to talk to you about something."
"Okay," he said. "Mind if I shower first? It's humid out there. I'm sweating like a pig."
"Sure," I said. "Actually, no, it can't wait." He set his keys down on the counter.
"What is it?"
It was so surreal. It was years of cohabitation, of alternating family holidays, of watching the same TV shows at the same time, of discovering new recipes and sharing bottles of wine. As much as I hated to admit it, my old boss had been right. Kenny and I had shared a life. We had built a life, and it was ours. It was mine. And I was about to incinerate it because of an office crush. Except it wasn't just an office crush. I wished it was. I really wished it was. I mustered up some courage and struck the match. Once I was able to admit to myself that I felt for her, I was able to understand how much I felt for her. The thoughts I'd been resisting poured through, a great dam breaking. I thought about her scent. Rose and cedarwood and coffee, usually. Her hands, soft, slight, her nails cut short. Her skin, perfect, dewy. Her eyebrows, untamed. Her lashes, thick with a natural curl. Her hair, wavy, the color of rich chocolate. Her long, regal neck. I thought about her fashion sense, about the grace of her movements. She had immaculate posture from years of dance. She was also an equestrian. She had gone to Yale. She laughed about it. One time we went to a post-work yoga class, and afterward she changed into her Yale sweatshirt and a pair of loose jeans. I pictured her wearing that, descending the steps of the Astor Place subway station, the passing uptown train blowing back her hair. I pictured a tiny brass key twisting inside a tiny brass lock. Was that the moment? Was that when it had all started? Or had it started the moment I first saw her in the office bathroom, her reflection materializing next to mine like some kind of magic. Our eyes met in the mirror, and poof, a forever change. I soaked in the tub of my hotel room until I pruned, until the only things I felt were abstract and I could pretend I was in a dream. I wrapped myself in a towel and sprawled across the king-sized bed, my wet hair dripping onto the pillows. I sipped a nip of gin from the minibar. I ate cold room-service French fries. I kept the eight ball in sight. I ignored the constant buzzing of my phone, likely Kenny or the mutual friends he'd already informed about our breakup. He had seemed upset, though I wouldn't have said devastated.
"If that's how you feel," he'd said.
"I still love you, it's just, I don't think we're each other's person, you know?" I hated myself for saying it, but I knew he would respond to it. I knew he could regurgitate this detail on future dates, to future girlfriends, to a future wife. They'd lap it up, I thought. He'd be fine. I knew he would be fine. He was now an eligible young bachelor in New York City, his IRA already set up.
"I'll miss you,"
he'd told me. "I'll miss you too," I'd said. I was afraid I meant it. "Did I make a mistake?" I asked the eight ball.
"Reply, Hazy. Try again."
I let it roll away from me. I turned over onto my back and stared at the ceiling. I thought about the color of Maggie's hair in sunlight. The next morning, I watched the sun rise over the ever-changing skyline of downtown Brooklyn. I counted the distant cranes. I yawned, then reached for the eight ball before anything else, before checking my phone, before brushing my teeth, before peeing. "Are you on my side?" I asked it.
"Most likely."
"Please. Tell me the truth."
"You may rely on it."
"I need you."
"I know."
I thought back to when I had found it at the Flea 2 weeks prior. I thought about whether I was grateful that I'd found it, whether I would have ever taken action if I hadn't. I thought about how that day, Maggie had told me I was indecisive. I'd always known I was, but I hadn't understood then what I did now. That it was all born of fear. I'd lived my whole life afraid, oblivious to my own trepidation. I wondered if the problem was universal or if I was particularly weak. I thought about how Maggie had brought up Kenny proposing. "Was she jealous?" I asked the eight ball.
"Better not tell you now."
"That's what you said. When we asked you if we'd be friends forever, you said the same thing." At first, I felt hopeful. Maybe it meant we wouldn't be friends because we'd be something more. But then I realized it could just as easily have meant that we weren't friends because I had confessed romantic feelings for her that were unreciprocated, unwelcome. I wasn't brave enough for any of it. I considered going back to bed, retreating into sleep, but then my phone started to ring. It was Kenny. "Should I answer it?" I asked the eight ball.
"Oh my God," it said. Then, "I'm exhausted."
"Sorry, I'm sorry." I didn't pick up. Instead, I rolled to the edge of the mattress and surrendered to gravity, let it do the hard work of getting me out of bed. I started packing, then decided I wasn't ready to check out. I extended my stay another night. I foraged in my suitcase for an acceptable outfit. I wanted to feel good in public, to look better than I felt. I put on a pair of wide-legged jeans and a sleeveless blouse. I had brought only one pair of shoes, classic kids, the soles worn hazardously smooth. "You want to come?" I asked the eight ball. I didn't know where I was going yet, but I knew I had to go somewhere. I couldn't stay in the hotel, staring at the walls and courting a Jack from The Shining mental state.
"Sure," the eight ball said.
I put it in my bag along with my wallet and my phone, now in airplane mode to stop its constant buzzing. I left the hotel and went around the corner to the snobby coffee shop where they served French pastries and exceptional espresso drinks. I got myself an almond croissant, a blueberry scone, and a large latte. I thought I would sit outside, where there were tables set up on the sidewalk, but decided there was too much traffic. I wanted somewhere more scenic. I walked in a daze until I was tripping over cobblestones in Dumbo. The Flea was there only on Sundays. On Saturdays, it was someplace else. Maybe Williamsburg or Industry City. Fine by me. I wasn't there for the Flea. I bought flowers from a bodega and positioned myself under the Manhattan Bridge. "Would you mind taking my picture?" I asked a stranger, who I suspected was also waiting for a photo op. "I can take yours, too." They nodded with such enthusiasm that I regretted asking, because I worried that I would disappoint with my lackluster photography skills. I let them go first. When it was my turn, I tried not to be self-conscious. I tried to let go of all judgment, of everything and everyone around me, of myself. I tried to just exist for a moment, in the moment, free of expectation, free of analysis. I smiled. I sat near the carousel picking at my croissant. I watched the 100-year-old wooden horses gallop around in the same circle. I wondered if they were bored. They must be, I thought. Poor things. I watched boats amble along the East River. I watched the slow drift of clouds. I examined the picture of myself under the Manhattan Bridge. I zoomed in on my face. I didn't look happy, but I did look pretty. There was, miraculously, no one else in the shot. I looked alone in the world, which was great for the photo, but not for reality. "Should I call Maggie?" I asked the eight ball.
"Yes, definitely."
So I did. "Hello, hello," she said. "Please tell me those pesky headaches are gone." "They are," I said with a twinge of guilt for lying. "Good. What are you up to this weekend?" "Actually, Kenny and I broke up last night." "Wait, what? Seriously, are you okay?" "Yeah, I'm fine," I said. "I'm at Jane's Carousel eating carbs, I'm fine." "Are you sure, Jordy? Do you want me to come?"
"If you want," I said, attempting to be casual.
"I'm there," she said. "Let me throw on some clothes and I'll grab a car." "No rush," I said. "I'm really fine."
"I believe you," she said. "Still."
We exchanged quick goodbyes and hung up. I wiped my hands on my jeans and took out the eight ball. In my head, I ran through all the questions I wanted to ask about the future, distant and not so distant. I wanted to ask what was about to happen. I wanted to ask what I should do. Should I tell Maggie how I felt about her? Should I wait? Should I keep it to myself? Carry the secret around, hoping it would eventually disappear. Was I ready to jump into another relationship? Did any of it matter? Even if Maggie did return my feelings, who could say how long it would all last? Maybe eventually I would feel indifferent about her, the way I did with Kenny. Was I searching for happiness in the wrong places? Seeking it in other people instead of turning my gaze inward? I swiped my thumb over the bold black and white number. Why 8? I wondered. Maybe it wasn't about the number. Maybe it was the symbol. Infinity. Maybe because there were infinite questions to ask. Maybe because wonder was limitless. There were so many variables, so many unknowns. I could sit with the eight ball forever, asking and asking, but never getting any closer to enlightenment, never learning a damn thing. It could never tell me what I needed to know. It could never give me any comfort, any guarantees, any confidence, any courage. It could only raise more questions, loop me into an endless cycle of need, questions begetting more questions. I thought about throwing the eight ball into the river, winding my arm like a pitcher and catapulting it into the murky waters among mafia skeletons and lost treasure and trash, but I couldn't bring myself to do it. I looked up and saw Maggie coming toward me, wearing her Yale sweatshirt, khakis and Converses, her hair in low pigtails. I asked the eight ball a silent question, promising it would be my last. It answered,
"Signs point to yes."